Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. With much of the world calling for an end of hostilities in Ukraine, NATO appears to have other ideas. Is Ukraine turning into Washington's next forever war? It certainly appears so. And it has nothing to do with Ukraine. Defeating Russia is the goal. Crosstalking the next forever war, I'm joined by my guest, Dimitri Laskaros in Toronto. He's a lawyer and a freelance journalist. In Hamilton, we have Kevin McKay. He is a social science professor at Mohawk College, as well as author of Radical Transformation, Oligarchy Collapse, and the Crisis of Civilization. And in New York, we have Jim Kavanaugh. He is a political analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules. In effect, that means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Dimitri, let me go to you first in Toronto. Well, it's all been but settled that Ukraine is not going to be offered membership, at least at the upcoming summit in Vilnius. But there's a lot of other ideas going on, and it fits perfectly with the forever war scenario. I mean, if Ukraine were to become part of NATO, then there would be a global world war. But if not, then the Biden administration, not achieving much success there, can avoid total defeat. And of course, the Ukrainians will pay in blood, and Western taxpayers will pay for the rest for the war effort here. It's a pretty devious plan, but that's what it looks like is in play. Dimitri.
Well, whatever the intentions of the Biden administration may be in the cabal of neocons that surround him, there's a different reality confronting the United States government now than confronted the United States government, let's say, in Iraq or Afghanistan, the two most recent venues of U.S. forever wars. And that is that the combatants on the American side, who are principally Ukrainians, are being attrited, killed at a rate that is far in excess of the rate at which American forces and other NATO forces were sustaining casualties in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so the reality confronting the Biden administration is that even if it plans for yet another forever war, Ukraine is likely to run out of soldiers a lot faster than the Americans would have run out of soldiers in those other theaters of combat. And the same is also true of the military materiel. It is being destroyed at a rate that is far in excess of the rate at which weaponry, NATO weaponry, U.S. weaponry was being consumed in those conflicts. And so I think that the American public's appetite or tolerance for the duration of this war is going to be far more limited than it was in the case of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And furthermore, you have two candidates, one on the left, RFK Jr., the other on the right, Trump, who are both talking openly about the insanity of this war and the need to bring it to an end. So the political playing field is also quite different. There wasn't anywhere near this level of opposition from political opponents of, you know, the incumbent administration in the case of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. So again, whatever the intentions of the U.S. government may currently be, they are confronting a very different reality.
Yeah, but Kevin, it doesn't, you know, common sense and being reasonable isn't usually part of a political calculus, unfortunately, in our day and age here. No, I agree with everything with Dimitri had to say here. But, you know, because they don't have a strategy for victory, they're going to try to starve off defeat, okay? And Dimitri's absolutely right. The cannon fodder are young Ukrainian men and Russian men as well. But they cannot accept that they've made a strategic error. And that's why, and again, I think it's very clever, don't let Ukraine into NATO, and they will have special security arrangements. They call it the Israeli option or whatever like that. They don't have any answers. That's why they're pursuing this. Kevin.
Yeah, I think that, you know, to Dimitri's point, it is a very different scenario today than the previous wars that have been mentioned, the sort of forever wars going back to, you know, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq. But I do think that a common problem is that so much of American politics is actually determined by, you know, non-elected actors, right? So you do have this massive, you know, it's been called the military-industrial complex. It's been called the deep state by various commentators. You have this machine that basically is based on war. It's driven by the economics of war. And that is something that any of the candidates that Dimitri mentioned are going to have to confront. I'm not so confident that that a Trump will actually have the strength to stand up to that machine. You know, an RFK Jr. might. But that's a serious challenge. And I think that there's other important players, too, when we look at the possibilities for peace or whether this war will extend. I think the international community has a large role to play. China's been stepping up recently globally in terms of initiating rapprochement between, conflicting parties that we never thought would be sitting down at the table of talks, such as Saudi Arabia and Iran. You have, African nations getting actively involved in peace talks. You have the BRICS playing a larger role. So I think that one of the X factors in this conflict, beyond what's happening on the battlefield, which I agree with Dmitry is horrendous for Ukraine, is, what's the appetite of the international community for a war that's going to go on, indeterminately? I don't think the appetite is there, and I think actually pressure is already mounting.
Well, I think that, with the African delegation that visited, obviously they're not there just, peace is a good idea in and itself. It's sorely affecting the developing world, particularly with this grain export crisis, which Russia is going to walk away from because the Ukrainians didn't honor it. Jim, let me go to you in New York. Part of this, unicorn's security arrangement that they're thinking about, they want to depoliticize it. They want to put it like over a 10-year period. That means voters can't get involved in it. And, and it's allocation money in advance. It's exactly what Kevin was just saying there. It is going to be non-elected actors that are going to pursue this here. That it isn't a political question for citizenry. And that is, again, a pretty despicable way to approach this conflict. Because in the way that that's being described, there is no end to this conflict. They're looking for ways to keep it going. Jim.
It is certainly not declared war again in the United States and everywhere else because they cannot. And not only in the United States is the political support very weak at this point, getting weaker, but in Europe, certainly in Germany, the political support is very weak. And the economic cost of this is greater than it was in any other war. The Europeans are paying the price for this, and they know it. And the citizenry does not want to go into a forever war. They cannot afford it militarily. They don't have the men or the materiel. They've already given, not only is Ukraine being attrited in terms of material, but that's all NATO equipment. That's all going and gone. And they don't have any more to give. They're running around to South Africa and Israel to get weapons. But I think their preferred strategy is going to be, once it's clear that the Ukrainian army is defeated, what they want is not a ongoing war like in Afghanistan or Iraq for 10 years or whatever. What they want to do is they're going to go for a ceasefire. All of a sudden, Blinken and all these neocons who are denouncing a ceasefire, they're helping themselves now by doing it, because when they turn around after the Russians defeat the Ukrainian army and say, now we want a ceasefire, now we're going to, we agree, okay, we're going to cede to your demands that you've been making for a ceasefire, but what they're going to want is something on the low-level forever war of a Korea, an armistice, like a Korea or Israel-Palestine peace process that goes on forever, that's never resolved, and you just keep, but they'll try to get peacekeeping forces in Western Ukraine just to make sure the peace process goes well, and they'll be giving themselves they'll kick the can down the road on all the final issues and keep a low level conflict going. Well, where they never recognize.
Yeah, but Jim, you're absolutely right. I can see all of these scenarios. The Korean one, no, because the U.S., North Korea, South Korea, and China agreed to that, okay? The Russians are never going to agree with anything that is suggested by Tony Blinken or Victoria Nuland. They're never going. They were openly lied to for 8 years about the Minsk process. The Russians feel burned by it, and they're not going to abide by anything. That's why, they want to keep this going, because they know that they have no unilateral decision-making process. Go ahead, Dmitry, before we go to the break.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that the U.S. government has made a lot of noises about wanting to freeze the conflict, to kick the can down the road and potentially rebuild the Ukrainian military. But I totally agree with you, Peter, that is not an option that's on the table.
That's not going to happen. I mean, that means that Russia would be a party to that. It's not going to agree. It's simply not going to agree. I don't know these NATO people. They're talking inside a fishbowl. I mean, have you thought about how the Russians might react to this? They don't do that. I'm sorry to interrupt, Dmitry. Go ahead.
And to go back to the point that was just made, what might transpire after it becomes apparent to the Biden administration that the Russians will have nothing to do with this frozen conflict scenario is a low-level Taliban-style insurgency, which wouldn't cost the U.S. government much, but which would be an enormous irritation and distraction for the Russian Federation for potentially a very long period of time. But even there, you know, as Kevin mentioned, you still have to deal with the reality that Europe is being significantly damaged by the economic warfare being waged upon Russia. Even the IMF, you know, has acknowledged that in the 2 years ahead, Russia will outgrow the economies of Germany and Britain. That's how severe the problem has become. And it's only going to get worse as we head into winter with the lack of access to relatively inexpensive Russian gas. And so the political appetite within Europe, which is a key player in all of this, is going to be very, very limited, even for a low-level, long-term Taliban-style insurgency. So I think the United States government is running out of options real fast.
Well, Dmitry, before, you know, we're going to go to break in a second here, but I mean, logically, I have to agree with you. But then again, look at the behavior of the Europeans for the last 15 months, which, you know, defies logic and common sense to me. What would make that change? We have 40 seconds before we go to the break. Go ahead.
Political unrest.
Okay.
The people of Europe will rise up at some point. I mean, we've already seen a tremendous amount of political instability in France. I think it's only going to get worse. I agree that the incumbent governments of Europe have shown themselves incredibly servile vis-a-vis the U.S. government. They effectively have done whatever the U.S. government had wanted, but the public's appetite or tolerance for this insanity is rapidly waning, and eventually there will be so much instability on the ground that they will be forced either out of office or forced to change their policies, I think.
All right.
When that'll happen,
hold that thought.
Pick.
Hold that thought. We're going to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on the next forever war. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing the next forever war. Okay, let's go back to Kevin in Hamilton. This conflict has just as been much about propaganda and controlling the narrative as it has been about military hostilities. Kevin, I mean, it's very interesting the way Western media describes the conflict. It's called the Ukrainian-Russia War, the Russia-Ukraine War, all these kinds of things. But really what it is, I mean, this time last year, the Ukrainian army had been destroyed, and it's been slowly but surely repositioned and with material, money, ammunition, et cetera, by NATO. So this is a NATO-Russia conflict, okay? We should say that and repeat it and correct people when they don't say it, because that's what it is here. Kevin, this is what I think is very, very dangerous, but also I personally think is an opportunity, because NATO is putting its reputation on the line, and it's losing, okay? Now, unless one party wants to go to the ultimate level of escalation, which, God forbid, we ever get there, NATO has dealt itself a pretty poor hand. Kevin.
I agree. I think NATO is in over its head. I think this is something that a number of the speakers have already mentioned or certainly hinted at today. I wanted to pick up on your point about mainstream media coverage in the West. And I think this is one of the very serious challenges that we face from the Western side to try to bring some sanity into our foreign policy, to try and bring an end to conflicts like this, is that the information we receive is so skewed. You know, you have decades of intense Russophobia in North America. This has been cultivated through, you know, the Hollywood machinery, mainstream media, you know, government. So that's a background. And then you also have reporting that's simply not accurate. And so one of the challenges we really face here is getting out accurate information about the causes of the war, about how the war has actually been unfolding, and about some real possibilities for peace. And so I think that this is a challenge that we really have to get better at here. Because to Dmitry's point about the role that the public can play in hopefully not having this conflict extend indefinitely, the public has to put pressure on our elected officials. This will happen, I think, more organically in Europe because of the economic crisis they're facing. But we need to see this in North America as well. We need to see North American citizens in Canada, the United States, standing up and letting their governments know that this cannot continue. And so this is a real project that we have to undertake here in the West. Like I said, injecting some sanity into our foreign policy. It's only going to be the people that will do that, I think.
Well, I'm very...
If I might just interject there, I'm sorry. To, I want Go right to point ahead. Out one fact, which I think is very important in this context, at least if you're living in North America, and that is despite the extraordinarily skewed media coverage and the enthusiasm amongst the mainstream media for this war, a poll that came out in February, which was quite surprising to the National Post, which commissioned it, found that only 32% of Canadians supported continuing to arm Ukraine. Imagine what that number would be if people were getting the facts. So even here in Canada, which has not suffered nearly as much economically as Europe has as a result of this crazy sanctions war, you see that less than a third of Canadians support continuing to arm Ukraine in a very pro-Ukraine media environment.
Exactly. That's very interesting, Dmitry, because you have the very powerful Ukrainian diaspora in Canada. I find that interesting. Let me pull in Jim here. Jim, I mean, kind of echoing what Dmitry and Kevin have said, this is an elite war. This is an elite narrative, okay? And because so much of the media is controlled, there's so much censorship right now. As you're aware, RT was thrown off of YouTube, and all other barriers are put in front of us here. And even after all of this controlled media and all the filters and all that, it's amazing the number of people that are beginning to change their mind. Your thoughts, Jim?
Things do get through. Another narrative does get through. You know, the viewership of these mainstream stations is terrible. There are millions more people watching Joe Rogan than watching anything on the mainstream media. And, you know, it is a divide that's happening now between elite media culture and popular media culture. That's why they're so intent on censoring the internet, because the stories do get through. The stories about Russia and Ukraine, the stories about Israel and Palestine that they don't want to tell, told, are being told, and people do see them. So what you have is this bizarre and dangerous divide between what people are feeling and what the mainstream media is showing and demonstrating. Don't forget, only 27-29% of the public is either a Democrat or a Republican. Most people are independent, but the media is all divided up among that blue and red tribalism. And that's the narrative they give. But people are going away from that. And, you know, I want to go back to the point that you said about, because what I was describing before was what I think the neocons think they can do. But I agree with you. I don't think they're going to do it. They do believe that they control everything and they can turn the war on and turn it off when they want. But there's another player here. It's not going to play that game anymore, and that's Russia, and that's what makes it so dangerous and unpredictable. To have this split between what this delusional idea that they get about themselves from their own narratives that are reflected back on them in the media about this is what we can do, and this is what the real story is, and everybody else in the world is saying, no, that's not the real story. That's not what you can do. So that's the real problem.
It's so interesting because we have so many different people from different countries on this program, and they all echo the same thing, is that, you know, this narrative coming out of the West, it's just nuts. It's illogical. It doesn't make any sense here. But, Kevin, one of the devious elements of this narrative coming out of the West is that it's about values. They always package it as values. And if, you know, you don't have our values, it means you don't have any values at all. And that makes it easy to demonize here. And I think that that's what I find, you know, sickening is watching, we have to protect sovereignty of Ukraine, but then they go around bullying South Africa, and diminishing its sovereignty. You have to choose a side, okay? Africans always tell me that. He said, why do we have to choose sides in a conflict that you created, Kevin?
It's been the time-worn challenge of empires to try and rally their populace behind wars that they'd rather not fight. And this is something that the United States has encountered, ever since its really expansionist history past World War II, and entering into the unipolar moment after the collapse of the Soviet Union. How do you get the American public behind all these conflicts? And there's a number of strategies they use. Obviously, they're spreading democracy. They're liberating peoples from oppressive tyrants. They use the language of values, but as ideology to mobilize people to try and suppress domestic opposition to these wars. So I think you're right. It's clearly it's nonsensical when you look at the actual behavior of the United States military around the world. Even if you look at their economic behavior, incredibly coercive, incredibly exploitative of less powerful countries. If you think about, you know, the Washington Consensus, this neoliberal model that has basically been imposed upon the developing world. So there's no values behind that beyond greed and exploitation. But of course, you can't be an American or a Canadian or a British or French politician and stand up in front of your populace and say, well, we're pretty much going to exploit these poor people, right? So yeah, they have to use the language of values. But it is nonsensical. And I think that this is one of the things that we need to be pointing out repeatedly when we speak to people in the West about this conflict, is we need to point out the incredible contradiction between the statements of values that are being made and the actual behavior of our governments in supporting this conflict. I think we need to highlight that contradiction as firmly as we can.
You know, Dmitry, you know, I think there's so much is at stake here. And we see it in the criticisms around the world of this conflict. And I don't know, maybe I'm, you know, going to the point of hyperbole here, but this is kind of an arc of history, 500 years of Western control of the globe, of international trade. It's being severely challenged right now. De-dollarization is going on now. We have institutions that are being developed beyond the West, out of the reach of the West. And it seems to me that Ukraine is turning into an inflection point, because this kind of domineering activity, not just since the Second World War, but ever since, you know, the exploration of the New World, which even itself is kind of in a colonial term. Am I over-exaggerating it, Dmitry?
Not at all. I think that the whole reason why we've seen this tidal wave of propaganda and McCarthyism, frankly, in the West towards those of us who criticize this war, is because the elites in the West, for them, this is existential. Not in the sense that their survival is at stake, although if they push the envelope too far, all of our survival may be at stake, but in the sense that their power is at risk, their dominance is at risk, and that's why they are throwing everything in the kitchen sink at this particular conflict, because if they lose this, it's all over. The gig is up, and in fact, I think it is up. It is up, and all they're doing is refusing to confront reality. The combination of Russia and China is an obstacle that is insurmountable for the West at this stage. The economic power, the resource power, the technological sophistication, the population, the landmass, and also the diplomatic power of Russia and China in the world today, particularly in the global South, is such that the Western elites can no longer enjoy the era of U.S. hegemony. It is over, and they are having to come to grips with that, and it is going to be a very, very rocky ride in the years ahead, precisely because they refuse to come to grips with that.
Well, exactly. Let's go to Jim here and reflect upon what Dmitry just said here. A hegemon never gives up easily. As a matter of fact, a hegemon will take a lot of powers around them down if it's necessary in defense of their position. And I don't see the U.S. being magnanimous about it, Jim.
That's right. I mean, I think it was Emmanuel Todd who said this is an existential fight for the Europeans and the Americans, for the EU and NATO, for the Western elites. And they're not going to, it's as existential for them as it is for Russia. And that's what the danger of this is. Look, it's, you know, the famous Lenin quote, sometimes it takes 10 years to do something, sometimes 10 years happens in a week, you know? And what we have is in the last year and a half, 10 years have happened, you know, and things that people didn't think were possible suddenly became clearly possible. I mean, Russia didn't know how it was going to, what was going to happen with the sanctions. None of the world knew what was going to happen militarily. People have been afraid of the United States militarily since the defeat of the Soviet Union. Within 6 months, everybody stood, oh, we can get away with this. We can live economically with these sanctions. You know, Russia is a military power that can stand up to the United States. So is China. Guess what? They sure are. And the rest of the world, the global South, you know, they are tired precisely of the sanctimony. They're saying, hey, we sat around for 30 years and the Americans came and gave us sermons and sanctions. Yeah,
okay,
and what happened? The Chinese come and give us an airport and the roads.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we've ended on a good note here. Tired of the sanctimony, because I think that's exactly what it is. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in New York, Toronto, and in Hamilton. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk rules.